It is so good to be with each and every one of you this morning. We're thankful for the ability to come together. If it's not COVID, it's something else. And today just happened to be some wintry weather. Yet we are Tennesseans and we are resilient. And we are not going to let a little bit of snow keep us from joining together tonight. Maybe Wednesday, who knows? But for today we are here. We're thankful for the ability to do so. Though we know there are many who travel a good distance to be with us. And it might be they were a little worried about the conditions once we get done. We understand that. We understand those who are not able to be with us this morning, but we're thankful to be able to live stream this assembly and the study together. We're thankful for that ability, and we pray for those who are not with us this morning for the various reasons. I ask you, if you don't already have your Bible open, you can turn it to either Mark chapter 8, or go ahead and turn to Mark chapter 10. So we're going to be this morning. I want to begin my reading together with you, Mark chapter 8. In verse 34, calling the crowd along with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone wants to follow after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." I wanted to begin with this text this morning to take us back a bit in Mark's gospel to remind us of this all-important text and how this text sets the tone for what is to follow within Mark's gospel account. Remember just previous to this that Jesus acknowledged the fact that he was the Messiah of God, the promised Christ. And with that came some very real and important ramifications for him in his life and for his disciples. He speaks of the fact that he's going to be killed as the Messiah. And let's recall that Peter then pulls him aside and rebukes Jesus, saying that such a thing is not going to happen to you, to which Jesus then pulls a reverse rebuke on him. And it rebukes him with even more severity, saying that he is aligning himself with Satan and the concerns of humans and not worried about the concerns of God. It is at this point, then, that Jesus calls the crowds together and delivers this verse, which again, let me suggest to you, sets the tone for the rest of what we're going to see within Mark's gospel. Because what we are going to see in this text, what we have seen, what we're going to see today, and what we are going to see is very strong teachings from Jesus from this point on. Yes, the teachings before have been important, and yes, they have been pointed, yes, they have been necessary, but it's at this point that Jesus is really going to get to the heart of what it means to be a disciple of his. What it means to be one of his followers. The first thing he addresses with his disciples is their lack of faith. He talks about that in chapter 9, in verses 14 through 29. That they didn't have the faith that they needed in order to accomplish what he had given them the power to accomplish. He then rebukes them later on in chapter 9 for their pride and their arrogance and seeking to be the greatest among themselves. He quickly follows up that teaching with a serious discussion on the absolute necessity of avoiding sin at all costs, even if it comes at a great cost. And then as we continue following the text in Mark, we come to where we are this morning. In Mark chapter 10, verses 1 through 12, where Jesus gives very strong and difficult teachings on the issue of marriage and divorce. This teaching that Jesus gave some 2,000 years ago is just as needed today as it was then. We are living in a time when marriage is not respected as God ordained. It is seen as something that is optional, and you can be married or you cannot be married if you want to engage in a sexual relationship with someone else. That marriage, we must understand, is not honored as it is said to be from Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. Many see it as something that you can jump in of and out of, much like a gym membership. You give it a try for a little while, it doesn't work out, so you cancel and you try something else. And what this has done, apart from not giving honor to this God-ordained institution, is it has had disastrous consequences, not only within our country, but throughout the world. What if I told you that according to a study in 2014, 40 to 50% of children in the United States of America were born out of wedlock? 40 to 50%. What if I told you that a 2010 study showed that nearly 10% of children were being raised in single-parent households? And while 10% might not seem that crazy or that terrible, that's nearly double from 50 years before. we might find a little relief. I've heard it said for years that the divorce rate just skyrocketing. Well, what if I told you right now the divorce rate has actually been declining for a few years? We might say, well, that's great. Well, except for the fact that it's probably declining because people just aren't getting married. People are not willing to make the commitment in marriage. They'd rather just cohabitate. Therefore, the divorce rate is probably dropping for that reason alone. What we need to recognize is this is an all-important issue. And yet I recognize this is a difficult issue, considering the emotions that are so often involved with such a subject. Yet, whenever it comes to being disciples of Jesus, when it comes to this subject and any other subject, this is what we have to do. We have to deny ourselves. We have to take up our crosses, and we have to follow Him, which means we have to lay aside emotion. We have to lay aside our desires, and we have to submit wholly to the Lordship of Jesus and what He says on this issue that His Father instituted even in the very beginning. A tough text this morning, Mark chapter 10, verses 1 through 12. But I'm confident that there is much here for us to be reminded of and for us to even learn this morning from this text. Let's read this text together. Mark chapter 10, beginning in verse number 1. Mark chapter 10, beginning in verse number 1. Let's read about God's servant's desires for marital commitment. He, being Jesus, set out from there and went to the region of Judea and across the Jordan. And then crowds converged on him again. And as was his custom, he taught them again. And some Pharisees came to test him, asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" Jesus replied to them, "What did Moses command you?" And they told Jesus, "Well, Moses permitted us to write divorce papers and send her away." But Jesus said to them, "He wrote this command for you because of the hardness of your hearts. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." And when they were in the house again, the disciples questioned him about this matter. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And also, if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." Again, this text is difficult. Yet I want us to consider what we find here before we ask three, I believe, important and necessary questions of application. Let's begin here. Just where do we find ourselves here in Mark chapter 10? Let's recall that Jesus has been up in Capernaum. We see that in chapter 9 in verse 33. Capernaum is in on the northern end. If you're imagining a map of Israel in your mind, it's up there around the Sea of Galilee, and it seems that Jesus is making his way southward. He's making his way towards Jerusalem for the final time. And as he is making his way southward, he comes into Judea, and there are people here who are going to be very familiar with him, for he has spent much time ministering in Judea. He has this crowd converge upon him, and in the midst of this crowd converging upon him, we find Pharisees coming to test Jesus concerning this issue of marriage and divorce. Let's emphasize the fact that they were testing him. My question is, why? Why are they questioning Jesus? What is the purpose of the questioning? What is the end result that they're trying to achieve? We don't know for certain, but I'm going to give you three suggestions. Number one, they could have just been, as Jewish men, and especially Jewish men of some authority and renown, they were just hoping to have their rights as they saw them validated. They were men who, in their minds, had the right to put away their wives, and they want to hear Jesus say, whenever they ask the question, "Can we divorce our wives? Can we do that?" for him to say yes. That could be what they're wanting. They're hoping to hear him affirm and validate what they already think. Or it could be that they were seeking to cause Jesus to be put at odds with those within the Jewish community. There was not consensus understanding of what this issue entailed from, from the text of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verses 1 through 4, which we'll visit in just a moment. Therefore, regardless of what Jesus said, if he said yes, then he would be put at odds against this group. And if he said no, for whatever reason, then he would be put at odds with this group. Well, what's the purpose of that? Well, if Jesus is at odds with those within the Jewish community, and particularly with varying respected leadership, established leadership within the Jewish community, then what's going to happen is his influence, his impact, his reputation might begin to be soiled in some way. But maybe, just maybe, the reasoning behind this testing here at this time in Judea is the fact that Judea was ruled by Herod Antipas. And we already know who that is because we saw back in chapter 6 that he had John the Baptist put to death, guess what, over this very same issue. We know they hate Jesus at this point. They do not want him on the scene any longer. Maybe knowing with what happened with John, they're thinking if we can get this man to hold to the same teaching, and if Herod can catch wind of it, then we can have Jesus taken care of as well. Again, we don't know for certain. Maybe one of those three. Maybe there's partially some truth in all of them. All we know is this is a test. They're doing this to test Jesus, to try to catch him up in some sort of way. And yet what I love so much about Jesus' response to this question where they come to him and they just ask, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Jesus goes to the source. And he responds to this question by asking, well, what was the command of God through Moses on the matter? You're asking, is it lawful? Well, let's go to the law itself. Is it lawful from Moses? Now, I want us here at this point, I want us to recognize how this conversation goes. How it goes from, is it lawful, to Jesus asked them what was commanded, and then their response, it is permitted. But before we get there, here's what I want us to recognize. As we're reading this text, and Jesus answers with, well, what did Moses command? Somebody might say, if they're unfamiliar with Scripture, they might wonder, well, why is he asking about Jesus? Or excuse me, why is he asking about Moses? Well, he's asking about Moses because they understood Moses, this man who was God's representative to the people of Israel during one of the most crucial times in their history, this man whom the law was named for, and this man who God spoke of as his very mouthpiece, this man, when he asked, what did Moses command? The implication that Jesus is asking is, what did God command? So it's not necessarily what did Moses command in his human wisdom. That's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is asking, what is the divine commandment on this? And I want us to see their response. Moses permitted us to write divorce papers and send her away. Now, hold your finger there. Put a marker there. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy 24 because that's what's being referenced at this point. Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verses 1 through 4. This is one of the sections of Deuteronomy where the law is being reemphasized, and there's kind of a shotgun blast in a sense of what's going on here. Some have suggested maybe that the way Deuteronomy is structured is these different sections of the text are giving greater explanation to the various Ten Commandments. That's how some have structured what is taking place here in Deuteronomy. But here in Deuteronomy 24, verse number 1, the text reads, if a man marries a woman, but she becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, he may write her a divorce certificate, hand it to her, and send her away from his house. And if after leaving his house, she goes and becomes the wife of another man's wife, and the second man hates her, writes her a divorce certificate, hands it to her, and sends her away from the house. Or if he dies, the first husband who sent her away may not marry her again after she has been defiled, because that would be detestable to the Lord. You must not bring guilt on the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. The issue here that is being discussed is, the question is it lawful? Jesus says, what did God command? They say, well, Moses permitted. Moses permitted this here in this text. Yes, he did. That is undeniable. The question is not what did Moses permit, though. That's not the question. The question must be, what did God command? Yeah, before we get there, let's backtrack a little bit and talk about the varying views from this text here in Deuteronomy 24. There are two main schools of thought within the time of Jesus. One being the teachings of a very famous rabbi named Hillel. And then there was another famous rabbi named Shammai. And they were very different in their understanding of this text, particularly. The school of Hillel was very lenient whenever it came to this text. And they would say that this text and the situations that it applied to were massive. That almost for any reason at all, a man could put into practice what is found here in Deuteronomy 24. And what they focused on is that part where there's something indecent about her, or other translation, there's some uncleanness about her. They took that and just ran with it. That could mean anything. That could mean something as petty, and I use that word purposefully, petty, as burning his food. She burned the biscuits. Hillel said, you can send her away. Now, the opposing school, the school of Shammai, was much more strict. And they said, no, that's not appropriate at all. And the only reason that this could be done is if there was some premarital sin, some premarital sexual relation that was uncovered in marriage. That's the only reason she could be sent away. So take that understanding historically, we can apply it to maybe one of those reasons why Jesus is being tested here. And we also can see their understanding of this text. Depending on what school they're in, they have a different understanding of why this was permitted at this time. But again, this is what I want us to recognize. Notice his train of thought here, the way the story reads. Is it lawful? Jesus says, okay, if we're talking about what's lawful, then we need to talk about what Moses and what God commanded. Well, they say, okay, well, it was permitted. And notice how Jesus responds to that permission. Let's remember, permission is not a command. The permission here was given for a particular reason. And that reason was the hardness of the hearts of Israel. I believe as we're reading Deuteronomy and we're having these Ten Commandments really fleshed out, that so much of that was based upon what was happening within Israel as they're going throughout this journey. That as they have the Ten Commandments given all the way back in Exodus 20, and then as they're making this journey to the Promised Land, and as they rejected the Promised Land because of a lack of faith and trust in God, and then as they go out on this journey, as they're preparing to enter in, Moses has had time to see how the people are responding to these commands. He has seen exactly the treachery that these people were capable of. And it seems to me to be that one of the issues that they were having was this very issue. That whenever a man took a wife and there was something he found out about her that he didn't enjoy, he would just put her out. And a woman in Israel who had been married and who had been divorced and who had been put out was seen as wasted scraps. As something that's already been used and useless at this point. Therefore, in Israelite culture, a woman who seemingly prior to this had been divorced and had been put out of the house, she was destitute. She was going to die. There was no one who was going to be able to care for her. There was nobody who wanted her. She was seen as somebody who could not be touched. Here, Moses permits, gives a permission. Why? For the hardness of their hearts. It was the evil and the wicked actions of the men within Israel that moved Moses, and we, I believe, can rightly infer God to give this allowance and this permittance. Yet, I want us to recognize this is not the command. The command is not to divorce your wife from the law of Moses as it was given. How do we know that? Because Jesus takes it back even further. He takes it back even further. He says it's not. He says we don't go just here to what Moses has said, because this is what was permitted. Oh, by the way, I need to mention this. What was the recourse if adultery was committed and proven? Deuteronomy 22:22, Leviticus 20:10, was that not death? If two individuals were caught in adultery, well, they were killed under Moses. So that even shows then the emphasis on what the command is. And again, the command wasn't first established with Moses. It was established at the very beginning. Because what Jesus does is he affirms God's original design for marriage. The original design, the command, the design. What was given from the beginning. That's why we can infer, I believe, that this permission, this what was permitted, this what was allowed, was simply a remedy for the evil that was being permitted. It was not the command. It was not the rule. It was not the standard. It was not what they were to base their marriages upon. They were not to go into marriage and think, okay, I'm going to give this a try, the Israelite man. I'm going to give this a try. If she just does do well, I'm going to write their certificate that Moses said I can write. I can send her away. No, that's not how it was to be. It was to be as God had established from the beginning. And that's what Jesus here quotes in Mark chapter 10 and verses 6 through 9. Notice Jesus says, but from the beginning of creation. Here we see the first words of the design of the marriage union and the focus, the purpose for it. The issue they were dealing with at the moment wasn't some new invention that needed ironing out. It was not as if marriage was something new that people were trying to figure out. Moses had been around for a long time. In fact, it is the oldest of human institutions known among mankind. But secondly, he says, from the beginning, he says, God made. God made. He, the creator from the beginning, he made. This is something, marriage is something that is given by God. Men did not think up and create marriage. The government did not think up and create marriage. This is something that was devised, created, designed, and established by God. And if God created it, he has the right to say how it ought to be carried out.
Amen.
So please tell me what among the creation is not under the rule of God? And the answer would be nothing. He created it all. Therefore, marriage itself is something he created, designed, and we are indebted to him to carry it out the way that he said it needs to be carried out. Well, how should it be carried out? Well, it should be carried out between male and female. From the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. And this fact alone is something that sorely is under assault, especially in our society. The subject of homosexuality is one that our culture is infatuated with. And they're infatuated with from the standpoint that they want the idea of men marrying men and women marrying women. They want to acknowledge that as being the same as the unions that exist between men and women. And to put it simply, that is not marriage as God designed it in the beginning. And try as our culture might to make these relationships equal, they are not. And they are not because that is not how God designed them from the beginning. And the same thing could be said about even a polygamous relationship. It is to be one man and one woman. And I also want to note here that there's an accusation leveled by some whenever it comes to the teachings of Jesus that Jesus never condemned homosexuality. He never said it was wrong. And he never said there was anything wrong with homosexual marriages or unions, whatever they might be called. Friends, if we're reading this text right here, we have Jesus himself laying out very clearly what constitutes a marriage. Here he says plainly that from the beginning, God made them male and female, and a man will leave his father and mother, and the two will become one flesh. The fact that he says it as he says it right here eliminates everything else as being legitimate in the eyes of God. And of course, this statement that Jesus says the two become one flesh, there's no longer two, but one flesh. These statements are taken from Genesis 2 and verse 24, the Logan read from us earlier. And it impresses upon us the reality of a marriage being the joining of two lives together in every possible way. We must recognize that there does not exist a unity among mankind that is on level with the marriage relationship. There is no relationship that we have that can equal it. Because there's to be a unity in focus, in purpose, and in fulfillment that cannot be found anywhere else. It is among these two individuals alone, this man and this woman, that they are to fulfill the needs of their spouses in a way that no one else on earth can. That is the special nature of marriage, that you have two people. And out of everybody else on this earth, fulfillment can only be found between those two people. Therefore, when you think of a husband, if a marriage is operating the way it ought to be, the wife ought to be next on the mind, and vice versa. When you think of a wife, the husband should be next in mind. The two have become one. And what Jesus goes on to say is, what God has joined together, let no one separate. And here's where Jesus really gives the answer, isn't it? Here's where Jesus gives the answer to this question. The question was, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Jesus here answers this most directly by saying, what God has joined together, let no one separate. The answer, in short, no. It's not. No, it is not lawful for a man to divorce his wife because he has pledged to her himself. And that pledge, that covenant that is created is not something that is as whimsical like a gym membership. It is not something that could be easily destroyed like some cultural contract. No, it is not simply cultural in nature. It is divine in nature. And it's divine in nature because it has been given by God and it has been established in the eyes of God. Two people have been joined into one, and it is not permissible for anyone to separate what God has joined together. Anyone who does such is going to incur the wrath of God in judgment. That's what this text leads us to understand. And yet, let's be honest. Though it is not difficult to understand, it can be difficult to accept. Let's be real. Let's be real for a second. This text can be difficult for people to accept because marriage has been made such a mess in so many places in our world. And yet, I see the Pharisees here really approaching the idea of marriage the way that I think many people do today. They're looking for that way out. They're looking for that way out there. They're not wanting to put in the work that marriage is. And marriage is work. Every single person here who's married knows that marriage is work. It is work to combine two lives into one. Yeah, people don't even understand that that is what has taken place by marriages being so disjointed. Where names are not exchanged. Lives are kept completely separate. Secrets abound. Brothers and sisters, that's not marriage. Marriage is a joining of two into one. We must recognize that marriage is not understood in our culture. It was not understood in that culture. It's not understood in this culture. And because of that, this lackadaisical attitude exists where people think they can hop in and out of marriage like it is nothing more than dating. Yeah, before we get to the questions, we need to recognize, what's the consequence of this? What is the consequence when marriage is not honored, when marriage is not respected, when marriage is not understood, and when the design of marriage as God gives it is not followed? What are the consequences? Let's see what Jesus says the consequences are in verses 10 through 12. As they leave this scene, you're probably here. And the sad reality is, as Jesus speaks, and as we might imagine this being a mic drop moment where he says very plainly, well, God is joined together, let no one separate, drop the mic thing, that should have been a mic drop. That should not have been anything shocking to anyone. That should not have been revelatory. Because it's been that way from the beginning. And yet even his own disciples still didn't understand. They go away from this place. They go into a house and they begin to seek further understanding and further clarification on the matter. So Jesus says again, very simply and plainly, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. Also, if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. This isn't difficult to understand. This is not complex. It's not complicated. Man or woman, which the fact that Jesus mentions women here would have been very extreme in that culture. In that culture, the fact that he's saying that a woman could divorce her husband, that's crazy. But if a man or a woman divorces his or her spouse and then marries another, the consequence is they're guilty of adultery. That's very plain. That's very clear. That's not difficult to understand. The rule is you don't divorce your spouse. You stay married for life. The only rights you have to any person is that first person you have committed yourself to. You have no right to another, and another has no right to you. That's simple. Until we introduce something that's already been introduced. The hardness of the heart. You see, if people approach marriage in the God-given way and carried it out in the God-given way, there's no need for any other discussion at this point. That's it. But because of the hardness of our hearts, we have a Deuteronomy 24 even today. And that Deuteronomy 24 exception is not found here in Mark. We'll talk about more about that in a moment. But it's found in Matthew chapter 5, and it's also found in Matthew chapter 19. And that Moses exception is that you can divorce your spouse if marital sexual unfaithfulness has been committed. And if that happens, Jesus says, then divorce is allowed to follow. But can I emphasize again that it is not commanded? If we have a husband and a wife, and a husband cheats on his wife, the wife is not commanded to divorce her husband. It is allowed. It is permitted. It is not commanded. Here we have the exact same situation that we have in Deuteronomy 24. Because the hardness of men's hearts, the fact that we treat our spouses evilly, and we commit the greatest sin possible against them by breaking that physical covenant that we have, that we have made before God, when that is allowed, when the hardness of our hearts is displayed in that way, Jesus says, then marriage can happen. Yet, let me emphasize again, it is not commanded. It is simply permitted and allowed. Yet, that might lead us to wonder, well, why? Why doesn't Mark say that? You ever wondered that before? Jesus says it twice. It's recorded twice in Matthew's account. It's not recorded here in Mark, and I don't believe it's recorded in Luke either. Why not? Could it be that this is the case because this is being overtly implied by what Jesus says within this text, that two become one? If a third enters into the picture, then what God has joined at this point has been separated. It has been defiled. It has been soiled. And the covenant that existed before God has been horribly damaged and violated. Thus, I think it is implied at this point that the marriage can be dissolved because the covenant has been broken. It can also be the case that the divorce exception isn't mentioned here because Jesus doesn't want to give the appearance that there is any sort of exception. Again, we often seek to live in such a way that we're always looking for the exception, and maybe Jesus here just didn't want to give the exception. He simply wanted to give the rule. The rule is one man, one woman for life. And once those two people have given themselves to one another, it is expected that only death will do them part. Jesus Jesus doesn't seem to be in the business of giving exceptions. He simply desired for people to do what his Father had established and designed from the beginning. Is this serious business? Is this the most serious of subjects? Absolutely it is. We've already talked about the horrible consequences that come whenever it's not followed. And I think this is why we see the apostles in other texts saying, hey, this isn't the case, and we shouldn't even get married. And you know what? That's all right. The people have. As I mentioned, that divorce is not commanded. To get married is not commanded either. And yet for those who do desire to be married and who do choose to enter into this union, it must be treated as seriously as it is for the sacred and divinely given blessing that it is. We must approach it well. Let's seek to do that in our last few minutes by asking three quick questions that can help us to work through this text and know how we can make application in this text. Number one, as far as these questions go, is this: do I understand the serious responsibility of entering into the marriage covenants? I think if we could get rid of one issue, I think if we could tack just one issue to begin with in our culture from the standpoint of marriage, it would be to get people to take it seriously. Get them to honor, get them to respect, and get them to recognize that it is not dating on steroids. That marriage is something altogether different. And that it therefore must be treated differently. However, we must recognize that this is simply not how people see it. And in not seeing it, and in seeing it the way they see it, they're not seeing it as God sees it. Let's reiterate that He created it and designed it to be for life, and we can infer that He did so because He knew in His infinite wisdom that this would be the best way for us to operate. He knew that this would be the best thing for human relationships. This would be the best thing for bringing children into the world. Because what we see all around us only proves His wisdom. Whenever we look around us and we see people jumping from person to person, or we see children growing up in divorce-ridden families, we see people who are emotionally scarred. And all we're doing is raising up a generation that continues to have no idea what marriage is. What these kids see in these horrible divorce-ridden families is they see something they want no part of. Or at least they begin to see it as this is how I go about it. And what a horrible thing that is. Therefore, for each of us who are married, or for each of us who plan to get married one day, we must approach our marriages or our prospective marriages with a high level of seriousness. We must recognize that entering into such a relationship is meant to be a lifelong endeavor. Lifelong longevity must be in mind. We must not enter into marriage thinking, you know what, we're going to give this a try. If it doesn't work, we'll just get a divorce. We'll go our separate ways. Brothers and sisters, that's not how it works. We must take it seriously. We must enter into it with the right goals. And we must work to accomplish those goals. And you know what happens when we do that? When we do that, we are setting the example. We are setting the example. We are helping to show the world what marriage ought to be. And maybe even most importantly, we're teaching any children that might be introduced into that marriage what marriage ought to be, to give them the best chance of learning so that they might do the same. The reality is that souls and generational health as far as relationships go hangs in the balance with the way we approach marriage. It's serious business. Therefore, here's our second question to go along with that, to build on that. Am I therefore then willing to do my part to make marriage what it ought to be? That's where it comes down to, brothers and sisters. It comes down to me. And yet at the same time, the problem is me. The problem is me. The problem with marriages today is that people are selfish. We have exactly what Moses talked about, what Jesus talked about, the hardness of our hearts. We are selfish people. And it is that selfishness that destroys marriages. To think that I'm just going to put that person away. I'm going to send them on their way because they didn't give me what I want or I need. Now I'm going to send them away because they didn't do what I wanted. It's selfishness in the purest form. And if we have that attitude, and if we behave in our marriage in that way, selfish, and if it's not corrected, we're going to be condemned for it. Whether we stay in the marriage or not, if we are selfish in our behavior, that will condemn us. And what that means then is that we must be willing to live within our marriages and to make sure that we are living selflessly for our spouses. That we are putting them before ourselves. I need to recognize that there is no one on this earth that can give my spouse what I can give them. And I must also recognize the reality that if I don't give that to them, I am almost surely inviting them to go find it somewhere else. I must take this responsibility seriously. And if I'm not yet married, if this is something I'm thinking about in the future, then I need to ask myself these questions. Is this person that I am dating, am I willing to give myself to them in every way to the fullest extent for the rest of my life? Is this someone that I'm willing to serve for the rest of my life? And if not, then I either need to find another person, or I need to recognize the marriage is not for me right now. I've got some growing and some maturing to do. Now, someone might respond to that, and they might say, well, the way you're approaching marriage, what about your needs? What about what you want? What about your desires? That's a good question. It makes sense. So we recognize again that marriage is two combined into one. And that whenever each individual in a marriage does this, everyone's needs are fulfilled. Everyone's desires are satisfied. Again, marriage is work. Marriage is service. Marriage is putting my spouse before myself. And if both are doing that, then both will be just fine. Yet it has to start with me. Because I can't control how my spouse behaves. I can't do that. None of us can do that. But I know what I can do. And by my actions, I can invite the same sort of actions. I must do my part. And may it never be said that I'm the reason for a failed marriage. That should be our goal. That should be what we're striving for. So that's the practical things. But here's one more thing I'll mention quickly. Marriage is more than just practicality. Marriage teaches us something. And we understand that from what Paul said in Ephesians chapter 5, where we need to recognize the deeper spiritual principles that are patterned in marriage. Do I recognize those things? Am I learning about God from my marriage? That's what Paul does in Ephesians 5. In Ephesians 5, we often go there to see what Paul teaches about marriage, but Paul really isn't teaching about marriage. He's just telling you what marriage is to teach you about Christ. That just as the wife in Ephesians 5, beginning verse 22 and going through verse 33 to the end of the chapter, whenever Paul recognizes that the wife is to respect and follow her husband as he loves and leads her, hey, that's the exact same thing that Christ does for the church. That the church is to respect Jesus and to follow him as he loves and leads her. Let me tell you, one of the best things we can do as married couples, for either those who are not married or for those who are in the world, is to show them what Jesus and the church is supposed to look like. And we do that by performing our marriage as well. When we as husbands imitate Christ in our marriages, and when we as wives imitate the church in our marriages, we are teaching people how things ought to be. But we can't teach unless we first learn that. and first embrace that and been willing to live that out in our lives. But then secondly, what I want us to recognize from this, something we learn from marriage is pain. We learn from marriage pain and heartache. And what I mean by that is when there is unfaithfulness in a marriage, that pain that I hope none of us know, but that pain that would be experienced is only magnified to the nth degree from God's perspective when he sees us being unfaithful to him. There's a reason why in the Old Testament, over and over again, time and time again, the relationship between God and his people is described in terms of adultery, prostitution. Why? Because there's a relationship there. There's a covenant there that has been established that God is their only God. And that these people are his people. Look at Judges, chapter 2. When the people prostituted themselves and bowed down before other gods, that pained God. And that same pain is seen within the marriage relationship whenever there's unfaithfulness. And we learn the seriousness of it and what God expects. As we think about marriage, we ask these questions. Do I understand the seriousness of it? Am I willing to do my part? Do I see the deeper spiritual implications? It leads us to this main point this morning, recognizing marriage as being God's and what he designed it to do. It leads us to this point of understanding this morning that marriage is God's institution. And we will only enjoy the fullness of its blessings by doing it his way. That's what we need to recognize. The people came to Jesus and they said, can we just put away our wives? Can we just divorce them, send them away? And Jesus' answer is no. No, that's not the way it's to work. You're to love them and to care for them. And you're to do so for life. Now we can spend all day talking about exceptions. But let's recognize those exceptions are only here because of the hardness of our hearts. If we do things God's way, we never have to worry about that. And think about a marriage that is devoid of blessings. Is it devoid of blessings because the spouses love each other so much? And because they serve each other in every way possible? Because they are selfless in every way? No, that's not why marriages fail. It's the exact opposite reason why they fail. Therefore, if we do things God's way, we'll enjoy blessings that cannot be experienced in any other relationship. We must recognize the great benefits of doing things his way with humility, with purity, and with service. May each of us, whether we be in marriage or whether we be considering marriage, may we take these things to heart. And may those who are not in such, or who do not desire such, may they be able to learn from the rest. So that all of us together might do our part in learning from marriage. That we may do our part as the bride of Christ. Because whether we enter into a marriage on earth or not with another person, if we are in Christ, we've been joined to him. We are his bride. May we live that way each and every day, showing the faithfulness to him that we ought to show to our spouses as well.